Hi guys, welcome to TYT. I'm really excited to be talking today to Allison Hartson, who is a candidate in the California Democratic primary. And she is running against a couple of people, including Dianne Feinstein, who is seeking a sixth term in the Senate. So thank you so much for joining us.
So happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Katie.
Could you tell us a bit about what got you into politics in the first place? I know that you worked as a high school teacher and you were raised in a working class family, and you saw kind of up close the divide between the haves and have-nots in this country. Can you tell us how your personal experience influenced your career?
Sure. I mean, it was a number of things. Really, it was seeing one issue after another related back to politics, related back to policy. So I was an English teacher. I also designed and taught an intervention program for our students who were at risk of not graduating high school. And it was in teaching that program in particular where I saw what these kids really needed to help. And this program was successful in keeping these kids off the streets, keeping them, they were statistically on track for prison, helping them to make sure that they could go on and do what they want to next with their life, should it be college or vocational school or career. And they were doing it. And I have students now from that program who have graduated from college. But as just one example of so many that I've seen, 2 years into that program, the school wanted to cut that program, citing that they didn't have the money for it. But meanwhile, they got something like a $10 million grant for computers that were being used only for standardized testing for our students. So you combine that with watching my students struggle to focus in school, struggling to do their homework and be, you know, have the kind of accountability and support that you really need in the community and at home, because their parents are working 2 to 3 jobs just to be able to keep a roof over their heads and be able to make sure that they can keep the lights on. And so many things that I see that our communities need, from a living wage to Medicare for all to a strong public education system from preschool through college. And instead, we're spending our money on senseless wars. We are spending our tax dollars on bailing out big banks, on bailing out big corporations every single year with the subsidies that we give them, not holding them accountable for paying their taxes. You know, the list goes on. And I saw and lived how this affects us directly in our communities. And when I stepped back at some point and said, what can we actually do about this? And you see that the protests aren't enough. They are helpful and we need to keep them up. But what we have to be doing is understanding how policy really drives these issues and help our working class communities to understand how it does come back to legislation. And once you see how every single issue we are fighting for does come back to legislation, it becomes a no-brainer that we either have to run for office or we have to get a lot more politically active.
And what about your own experiences? So those are the issues you saw with the students you taught and how the school system is run. What about your own issues growing up and your family and health insurance? And I know that you had some issues with that in your family, people struggling with medical issues, and you saw kind of firsthand the dangers of our privatized healthcare system.
Yeah, sure. So I have 8 brothers and sisters, a pretty large family. And in my family runs a couple of health issues. So on my dad's side, it is cancer. It's colon cancer and pancreatic tumors, which have been found through my family's diagnosis to be connected. And then on my mother's side is breast cancer. And so many people on my mother's side have died from that, including my grandmother, who was kind of like my second mom. She lived with us and helped to raise me while my mom worked 7 days a week to pay the bills. And then on my father's side, my grandfather passed away from this disease. My father passed away from a pancreatic tumor. I have a sister who passed away from it. I have a brother who passed away from it. I have another brother who is still alive and has actually had his entire colon removed in order to fight back against these polyps and prevent them from turning into cancer. And all of this, of course, requires medical treatment, and it requires insurance if we're going to be able to get that treatment. But because this runs in my family, that means that there are pre-existing conditions. And so my brother, who when my father passed away, my brother was 15 years old and I was 20. And so my brother ended up having insurance for just about another year on my stepmom's insurance, but then she lost her job. And she lost her job in large part to struggling with the depression and the stress of my father having died. And she didn't work while my father was alive. He was the one who worked 7 days a week, and she stayed home and took care of the kids. So then she had to go out and get a job. And then, you know, all of those pressures combined, she ended up losing her job. They lost their insurance. But my brother had these polyps, meanwhile, in his colon that were growing since he was about 11 or 13 years old when he was diagnosed. And so the doctors told us that he was probably not going to live past about 2025 if we didn't get this surgery, but it was going to cost an enormous amount of money we couldn't afford. And so what we had to do to get him that was pretty terrific, actually. And I wrote about this. People can find out a bit more of the details by going to my website and looking at my some of the stuff that I've written. Anyways, we ended up getting him the surgery that he needed, and we had to move mountains to make it happen, which drove my stepmom and others even further into economic stress. And she ended up being homeless for a little while as a result of all of this compounding. And then my brother ended up having a son, a beautiful boy, and he has the same condition. But it is because now of Obamacare and addressing the pre-existing conditions that he is able to get medical care. So I know personally like how incredibly important Medicare for All is for all of our families. But you know, we have to also expand Medicare too. So we're going to have to make sure that it is more comprehensive once we make it available for, make sure that everybody has it. We have a lot of work to do there, but we need to do it much sooner than later, because even with the Affordable Care Act, my brother still can't afford it for him and his son. And I have another sister who doesn't qualify either, who can't like get on the ACA, or who can't even afford it, and also doesn't qualify for it.
Right.
So, you know, we know that like the ACA, it helped so many people, millions of people, but there's still millions of people left off. So we have a lot of work to do in that regard.
Right.
But I'm passionate fighting for this.
Yeah, and it seems like that's an issue that really attracts support on a bipartisan level. Like, people have political differences. They may believe in different things in terms of taxes or social issues. But I think a lot of people get that you shouldn't, in this country, especially where we have so much like medical research, so much technology, that it's really unnecessary to die from lack of treatment.
It's
mind-boggling when you think about it, right?
It is. It's like being stuck in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
You have to be rich in order to be able to have medical treatment that is it can help you to completely avoid death. But
right.
The other thing too is quality of life.
Right.
So there are some people who might get medical treatment, but they don't get quality medical treatment like people who are wealthy do. And so we have to address that as well.
So like you mean the gap between just an actual quality of treatment?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's proven, that those who have more money will live longer because of the access to treatment that they have, even if it's just like the daily medicine or pills that they take. So I have a sister who lives in poverty in West Virginia is where she is, and she has access to some medical care. But it is so minimal, and it costs her so much money that she doesn't have just to go because she's having pains. And right now, I'm very, very concerned about her health. But she doesn't want to go to the doctor because she's afraid of what they're going to say. And how do you live with being diagnosed with something that is really, really scary? But being told you have to have a certain amount of money in order to treat it, and that just compounds the stress. And so you just don't go to the doctor. And then the more you don't go to the doctor, the worse your situation gets. That's what my dad did. That's what my brother who died did. That's what my sister is doing right now. And so I mean she has problems with like dental problems with her teeth. She has and a lot of this comes back to as well like how we the kind of food that we eat. If we don't have access to as good of food as well because we don't have money
Right, it's
to buy
expensive.
healthier food, yeah, it over the years that weighs down on your teeth, it weighs down on your gums, it weighs down on your insides. I mean, it's
No
we
pun
could go
intended.
on and on and on. Yeah, we could go on and on and on about how it decreases the quality of your life.
Yeah.
And so that's what this healthcare is also about.
Did you have a eureka moment when you knew you wanted to enter into politics? Was it a gradual thing?
Well, it was a gradual thing. So when I first like got and started in politics, I signed up to volunteer with every single Get Money Out group that I possibly could. And it was like really what I wanted to do was find out what are our options for correcting this mess that we've gotten ourselves in. And so I just had the intention of signing up to volunteer, go to these meetings and just sit back like a fly on the wall and just listen and learn from the people who have been doing this for a long time. And so as I was learning more and getting involved, I was really frustrated with the fact that I didn't feel like any of the groups had like a final solution to actually fixing these problems. And that's what led me to eventually continue my research and find Wolfpack. So it was through this whole kind of journey that I was learning about the political process and about policy and how all of these things tie together to these issues. But as far as like running for office, honestly, it's not something that I have personally desired to do. I don't know that, anybody would really want to, like any sane person would really want to actually get involved in the corruption that we are fighting, to actually like go and sit there and do that and be surrounded by that day in and day out. And so I struggled with it, but I through the many conversations I had with the team of people, that I was talking to about this, including my family, whether or not to do this. I really ultimately landed on, if I don't do every single thing in my power, then I have to take responsibility for what's happening to this country. And I know that at the end of my life, I will regret the things that I didn't do, not the things that I did. And this is so incredibly important for other people's lives that it was not a decision I took lightly, and it wasn't, and I entered into it saying, like I do everything in my life, like once I say yes to something, that's it. I go in head first.
Yeah, it's funny. It's kind of like with administrators in general. I've often found that you want the people, the best administrators are actually kind of the reluctant ones because you don't want power hungry people going into these positions. So.
That's true, and it's actually something that when I was running Wolfpack, one of my biggest things about finding people to step up and put into some kind of leadership role was actually the people who wanted it less.
Right.
And it's like you, and there's kind of something we talk about in the activist world, that usually the people who raise their hand first are the last ones you want to actually do something.
Right. That's funny, yeah.
And not because they won't be good or don't have good intentions, but it's usually they just have a different agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And so what ends up happening is when it doesn't work for them, when things get tough, and they always will, they're less likely to be able to withstand the challenge.
Right, because if they're not in it for their issues, reasons, but maybe they have some ulterior motives. I mean, there's a combination. No one's 100% right, one thing or the other, but...
And when it comes to specifically our government, by not having people in there for the right reasons, they're more susceptible to be corrupted by the power.
Self-interest, yeah.
Exactly.
So what is the difference between you and Dianne Feinstein? I mean, you guys are in California. She's a Democrat. Why do we need someone else running? She's a liberal, right? She's open-minded. She was friends with Harvey Milk. I'm playing the devil's advocate.
Right.
No disrespect to Harvey Milk. Great, 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 great.
Oh, yeah.
Organizer, no. Politician, yeah.
Well, you know, Dianne Feinstein is the epitome of the corruption that we are fighting in our government. She has, throughout the years, taken money from PACs, from dark money interest groups, from corporations. You can look at her contributions from defense industry and her vote for war, including the Iraq War. Look at her donations from AT&T and the telecom industry as a whole, and her vote for the Patriot Act every single time, granting permission for warrantless wiretapping on us citizens. So it really is the epitome of so much of what I've been doing to fight to get big money out of politics. But also there's kind of this class warfare going on, that this kind of battle, so to speak, of me and Dianne Feinstein, it really is the people versus the machine, the working class versus the elite, who are just not capable of understanding our daily lives, what we go through. The struggle to have to decide, as I watched my family have to decide as I was growing up, to have to decide between if you're going to pay for medicine or go to the doctor, or if instead you're going to make your husband dinner. I saw my parents have to struggle with that decision, you know, or if you're going to put gas in the car, or if you're going to pay the electricity bill, which one is more important to you that week? And you're paying your bills weekly, just trying to figure out what you've got day by day, week by week, let alone monthly. And so, not being able to relate to us, lacking that empathy as a corporate class, wealthy elite person, how on earth are they making decisions that govern our lives? I just don't even think it's possible. So we have to get into office, but we're going to have to do a lot to restructure the way our campaigns work, so more people from the working class can run for office and win. And we're going to be able to do that by replacing privately funded elections with publicly funded elections, which is one of my biggest goals.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because sometimes there's a lack of empathy. You know, Hillary Clinton famously said at one of her Goldman Sachs speeches that, you know, people like her, in a moment of actual, I think, genuine self-reflection, said that it's hard for wealthier people to stay connected to working people because they're just not in touch with that reality. But you do have a lot of Democrats who are, you know, part of the 1%. But to be fair, to them, they still vote against their own, at least short-term, economic self-interest, right? They don't vote for their own tax breaks, right? That's one of the differences, to the extent that there are, between Republicans and Democrats, is some Democrats are like, well, I deserve to pay more because of my, you know, privileges, right? But can you talk to us about Feinstein's vote when it came to Bush tax cuts?
Yeah, she voted for the Bush tax cuts. So she, you know, she really is more Republican than she is Democrat. And anything that she speaks on that sounds liberal, is not really reflected in any kind of legislation that she champions. So, for example, she talks a lot about empowering women and fighting for female or for just gender equality. But where is that fight? Where is that championing? Based on research, we know that one of the best ways to make sure that we have equal pay in the workplace is to ensure paid family leave and paid parental leave. Where is that? I don't see that anywhere. I don't see her fighting for that. You know, she is, people often talk about what a champion she is of gun reform. But the research shows that the actual number one way to lower death by gun is to close loopholes on background checks, which is supported by over 90% of people. But what the legislation she continues to introduce is to ban bump stocks and assault weapons. And so these are important policies, but if we're serious about looking at the root cause of a particular issue so that it can actually be solved, we have to look at evidence-based research, and the research shows that it's closing loopholes on background checks. But instead, jumping on the political bandwagon to be talking about bump stocks and assault weapons, which again, I agree with, we need to look at those AR-15s, right? This gun has been consistently used for these mass shootings. So we need to address that. But we also need to be fighting hard to close loopholes on background checks. She's not doing that. And then when it comes to Medicare for All, I mean, just last year, she was repeating a Republican talking point that it's a government takeover. We know that's not true. What we're talking about is insurance. What we're talking about is single payer to make sure that we can actually make it easier to run insurance and provide that health care, and how much money that's going to save us. But here she is, copy-paste talking points from Fox News.
With Democrats like these.
Yeah, immigration, she is on record talking about how conflating illegal, I use quotes because we could talk about what's really legal, right? But she conflates illegal immigrants with criminals. Who do we keep hearing say that?
Republicans. Who does that? Yeah, especially right. Donald Trump. Isn't that like one of his biggest negatives, you know, minuses? Mm-hmm. One of the things we hate about him,
She's on video talking about how we need to clamp down on immigration in order to address criminals coming across our borders.
I think we can enforce our borders. I think we should enforce our borders. To have a situation where 40% of the babies born on Medicaid in California today are born of illegal immigrants creates a very real problem for the state, which is in deficit.
Look, of course you can enforce the borders.
Let me finish.
I agree.
To have 17% of our prison population at a cost of $300 million a year be illegal immigrants who come here and commit felonies. That's not what this nation is all about.
She just comes overall from kind of a bygone law and order era.
Yeah.
and
a very error and era.
Yeah.
Mistaken era, yeah.
And but she comes from this era where she hasn't progressed, and it's not as much how long she's been in office. It's not really age either, because we can look at Bernie Sanders, who's old. You know, he's quite a bit older as well.
Right.
And he's been
he's
in office.
Also chronologically empowered. We can call that. I'll just make that up.
There you go. I like it. And he's been in office to some degree for a really long time, as she has. But he's been on the right side of the issues for decades.
That's really crazy.
And he continues to read and learn and evolve and become even more progressive. And so if we just look at the ideas, if we just look at the voting record, if we just stick to the policy, she is more of a Republican than anything else. And so we are significantly different on, I would say, every issue.
Right. And what about her fundraising and your fundraising? Are they at all different?
Just a skosh. So the average race for the U.S. Senate is $10 million here in California. She has $15 million right now just for the primary. And $5 million of it she donated to herself. The vast majority of the rest of it is from large donors and PACs, political action committees, right? Dark money groups. And I think it's less than 5% of it comes from small dollar donors, being $200 or less. My donations, 72% of my donations is from small dollar donors. The rest is from what is called large dollar donors, meaning $200 or more. And I have no PACs that have contributed to me. I don't accept money from corporate PACs at all whatsoever. And so we've raised with my campaign, I think we're just under, we're either still under 400,000 or under 500, but less than $500,000. And what we've been able to do with that money to build the infrastructure that we have with my campaign has been exceptional, even for my standards. So yeah, we have over 1,900 volunteers for my campaign. I mean, it really is a people's movement. Those small dollar donations translate to individuals, into human beings. I think right now my average donation is $29. And so, you look at, combine that with social media. So we really put our money into that aspect as well, in addition to supporting my volunteers. And on social media, I am outdoing every single candidate in this race 6 to 8 times every single week, meaning more people coming to my pages, liking them, sharing them, commenting on them, engagement. And again, that translates to real human beings throughout the state who are engaged in this campaign.
Yeah. And, so, that's great. And can I just quickly mention a poll that just came out? Okay. So a poll just came out when, an Emerson University poll, which was released Monday, right, of this week. And it shows that Senator Dianne Feinstein faces viable challenges from 5 of nearly 30 opponents. Feinstein, 84, is running for a 6th term in the U.S. Senate. The poll shows 5 of Feinstein's opponents are statistically tied for the second spot in the top 2 primary. State Senate Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon, self-finance lawyer Eugene Patterson Harris, 2 Republicans, and 37-year-old former teacher Allison Hartson. Hey, how come they don't name everyone else's age? Anyway.
That is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow. That is very interesting. Were you surprised by this? Did this make sense to you? And what are the differences between you and the other primary challengers?
No, I'm not surprised by it at all. It actually reflects the internal data we have from the field that we're doing, knocking on doors and making phone calls. Our data shows that I am beating Dianne Feinstein and have a chance to come in first place, but this isn't what the polls are going to show. The challenge there, of course, is making sure that can translate into numbers and being able to reach enough people around the state. But our data, it's showing that within 30 seconds, we are able to change somebody's mind because all they have to do is hear. I mean, we have a winning message, right? Like making sure that we fight corruption and bring integrity back to our political process and really focus on policies that are in the best interest of people and not concerning party. And so that's easy. That's a no-brainer for people, but they just have to hear about the campaign. Considering that not as many people are going to, of course, be able to hear about the campaign as like Dianne Feinstein can reach because she's an incumbent and she has the corporate media covering her, then accounting for that, the fact that I am statistically tied for second place is not shocking to us at all, but it's definitely encouraging. Not all of the polls include me. That every poll has its own way of running whatever metrics they do. It's been very interesting to see how this works. But the polls that have included me, I've been statistically tied in almost every single one of them.
Wow. That's interesting because even this one makes it just about, like, it doesn't even talk about you versus Feinstein. It's more about you and the other opponents.
And as far as them, I guess I didn't answer that part of the question is, compared to the other opponents, I'm the only one that is not taking money from corporations or PACs, or self-funded. All of them are one of those.
You and your purity politics, right? As
I would say, yeah. Yeah, right.
And so what happens between now and the day of the election, and what can people do to support you or find out more about you?
So the best way that people can help is to go to my website, alisonhartson.com. It's A-L-I-S-O-N-H-A-R-T-S-O-N, and sign up to volunteer. Our team will get in touch with them immediately. They can also just go onto my website and actually schedule an event where they host an event themselves to go out and canvas and knock on doors. If you've never done it before, we train you how to do it from the very beginning. It's such great experience too, if you've ever wanted to know how, what it's like to be part of a campaign. If you can't canvas, we can phone bank. You can phone bank from your house. Again, no experience necessary. We give you all the tools that you need. And that's what we'll be basically doing. We've got some other fun projects in store as well. So best thing is to just go to my website, sign up, make sure you're following me on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and sharing. Getting the word out in your sleep if you can.
But not while on Ambien. Or if on Ambien, don't be racist you're doing it. Yeah, we're an equal opportunity. What can you just remind people of your handles on social media? Just once more?
It's the same handle everywhere. Hartson, 4CA. 4 is spelled out FOR.
Okay, so HARTSONFORCA.
That's
great.
Right.
Great. Thank you so much, Allison Hartson.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay, bye.
Bye.